Support for WPR comes from Stone Harbor, a Door County resort and conference center overlooking the historic Steel Bridge in Sturgeon Bay. Details about hosting a wedding or conference are at stoneharbor-resort.com.
Support for WPR comes from The Alliance, a not-for-profit cooperative committed to helping employers self-fund by providing data and insights to manage their health plans. Info is at the-alliance.org.
You know, we're really lucky to have such a diversity of wildlife here in the state, and no matter what time of year, always something to look at and to enjoy. Larry Mueller here. David Drake, our guest today, a wildlife specialist with UW Extension, and he's an associate professor in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. Good friend and a colleague of another guy we hear once in a while on the program, too, Scott Craven. David, always great.
Well, Larry, it's always good to be back, and I'll take it as a compliment you keep inviting me back.
Well, we always have a lot of fun when you're here, and there's plenty to talk about. I want to give our listeners a chance to join in. If you have a question or comment, maybe you're looking at some wildlife you'd like to learn a little bit more about, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. What have you been seeing lately? Email us at talk@wpr.org. Maybe you're a hunter. What seasons do you look forward to, and why? Or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You can post a question or a comment there. I'd love to hear from you. Real homecoming, a very cool homecoming, I think, of sorts. Sturgeon returned to the Menominee Indian Reservation. That's a pretty cool story. That's after 125 years.
Isn't that something? Those fish, I don't know if many people have seen sturgeon or even where the sturgeon are in Wisconsin, although I'm guessing they do because it's pretty well publicized, especially in Lake Winnebago. But they can get to be a rather large size. They're very prehistoric looking. They've got a row of scutes or kind of armored plating down the back, the ventral side, and on each side of their body. And the skin, I've not ever caught a freshwater sturgeon, but when I lived out east, we caught sturgeon out in the New York River, which fed into the Chesapeake Bay. And the skin is as rough as a shark.
Yeah,
and we had to actually score the skin with a very sharp knife and then literally take a pair of pliers and just rip the skin off in just sections. But the sturgeon, they're good to eat. Roe, you get the eggs from them, which is, you know, a form of caviar, and that's always a nice thing to have. And they really are a really just prehistoric-looking fish in there. And evidently, the DNR's got a program going on with the Menominee Nation right now, and they're releasing up to 100 sturgeon over a 10-year period. And this was supposedly the second year of the 10-year reintroduction.
Yeah, so it's really cool. And I think they were lost because of dams.
Yeah,
and
supposedly on the river. And so they're bringing them back. They historically should be in that river, and they're bringing them back now. So that's a good thing to see. And, you know, it's another testament to the fact that wildlife is pretty resilient if you give it a chance.
Absolutely. DNR just finished public hearings about Wisconsin's elk populations. What are they thinking of doing, and what's been the public's response?
Well, I think the public's response has been really favorable. And one of the things they're trying to do is expand the number of elk up in the restored Clam Lake area, and that was the first restored elk population. And again, elk is a native species to Wisconsin, and was here historically.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think that they're also trying to possibly expand to put a second population over in the Black River Falls area. And so they just concluded public hearings, I think, last week on that. And they had quite a few people come out, and overall, extremely favorable about that. And obviously, I'm not sure it's all altruistic, because obviously that's a very large game animal, and a lot of people go out west and pay good money to hunt elk. So I think that there's probably some interest that hopefully, in the long term, that we could have a huntable population of elk in Wisconsin again.
And, of course, you get the wolf season.
Yeah, that's started two Mondays ago, October 15th. And it could potentially run through February 28th of 2013, so next February. If they reach their quota, then they will shut the season at the time the quota is reached. But as of this morning, they have harvested 22 wolves, 8 females, 14 males. And surprising to me, at least, 50% of those wolves, so 11 of the wolves have been taken with gun. And 11 have been taken with leg hold or foothold traps. And I think certainly with wolves being a somewhat secretive animal and kind of shying away from humans, that trapping is obviously the more effective way to go. So I'm surprised that there are as many wolves being harvested by gun right now.
We have a quiz, by the way, that relates to wolves, a quiz for today's show. And the question is, and we've got a prize associated with this, what is the maximum number of wolves that will be harvested during the 2012-2013 wolf hunt in Wisconsin? And so that the maximum number that would be harvested, and unless, as you say, it goes to February 28th of 2013, the season, unless the harvest quota is met before that, anyone holding a current wolf license is responsible for knowing if the season is open or closed. And so, tell you what, we've got a little quiz. So if you tell us how many, what is the maximum number of wolves that will be harvested during the 2012-2013 wolf hunting season, we will send you a prize. And the prize, I'm looking around here to find the prize. There it is. Okay, the prize is the book, Phantom of the Prairie, The Return of Cougars to the Midwest by John Laundrie. And an interesting book about the return of the cougars. So here's how you do that. If you've got the, I think you got the answer, I want you to email it to talk@wpr.org. Please put quiz in the subject line and also include your first and last name, where you live, and where you live in the message. So first, last name, where you live in the message. You can also call 1-800-642-1234 with your answer. But you may run into busy phone lines, but give it a try. Call 1-800-642-1234 with your answer, or probably better yet, email to talk@wpr.org, and please put quiz in the subject line. Also include your first and last name and where you live. We'll give you 10 minutes to get your answers in, and then we'll divulge you. And then, of course, if there are people, more than one person with the right answer, we'll do a
random draw
of some sort. And again, the question, what is the maximum number of wolves that will be harvested during the 2012-2013 wolf hunting season in Wisconsin? Yeah,
Judith has guaranteed us that the drawing of the correct answer is all fair and above board.
Yes. Yes, she has. Bob in Krivitz has a question for you. So let's go to Bob. Hi, Bob.
Good morning. I was listening to you on the sturgeon as I was in the workshop here. I've helped out with the sturgeon at Shiocton quite a few times, but you were talking about different sizes. Okay, up at Lac des Flambeaux Indian Reservation, right in the city, about 30 years ago, two young fellows up there, teenagers, caught one on hook and line right above the dam, and it's been mounted by the city. It's hanging right now in the library if somebody wanted to see a large one. It's 7'1", 196 pounds.
Whoa.
And that's been verified. This was about 30 years ago. I read the article in a Minocqua newspaper when I was up muskie fishing. So I drove over to see this thing, and I photographed it, and they have a 40-pound muskie hanging next to it, and it looks about like a minnow. If somebody wants to see a huge one, it's there. It's right on the main street in the city of Lac des Flambeaux.
Lac des Flambeaux.
You know, there's a lot of interest.
Thanks, Bob.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you very much for that. There's a lot of interest in sturgeon. And you know, just as an example, there are a lot of people that go out in the spring and just guard sturgeon so they can't be taken illegally as they go up into Lake Winnebago. And so people are literally sitting out in lawn chairs all night long, just kind of keeping watching these fish. And so there's a lot of people who have a great sentimental interest in those animals.
I had a great story of a friend of mine who was learning how to scuba dive. And finally it got to their first dive to go, just to go down. And so it was a whole group and about 10 of them. And they were at in Lake Mendota in the University Bay, where it's fairly, you know, 10 foot deep or so. And they all went down and they were in a circle, sitting, you know, in a circle and just sort of getting used to being under the water and all. And he said about a 7-foot sturgeon swam right into the middle of the thing. And he said everybody just went for the surface, scared the heck out of him.
You know, I always think about it, kind of think back to being the first person on Earth, and you're wandering the Earth and you see some of these animals and just how remarkable that has to be to see this for the first time, or even if you are alive now and you're seeing it for the very first time. It's pretty impressive.
We have, on our Facebook page, Lucy posted a photo of a mama bear and three cubs. So if you want to see a mama bear and three cubs, Lucy, thank you so much for posting that on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. By the way, you don't have to be a member of Facebook in order to get online to actually see that. You just can't add to it unless you're a member of Facebook.
Yep, and we get questions about this time. Are the bears in hibernation? And clearly they're not yet. So that's a good testament right there. I'm not sure when the picture was taken, but it also looks like they're out gathered around a bait pile.
Yeah.
So, but they look healthy, and they should be heading into hibernation here pretty soon, especially as we're supposed to at least get down into the mid-20s here in the southern part of the state at the end of this week. So that will start triggering some of these animals start moving toward hibernation. That along with the decreasing day length.
Mm-hmm. All right, so let's go to Judy in Reedstown. Judy, hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, this is a little bit contrarian. I own and pay taxes on 180 acres, and I'm very disturbed by the increase in hunting seasons. They begin in August, and they run at least until January. And what the DNR does not do is pair these expanded seasons with some more, better training on hunter behavior. I have had the most bizarre things happen on my land when people knew I wasn't home. Last year I had guys driving all over my property with four-wheel drive, three-quarter-ton pickups, and they had lawn chairs when they and their beer bellies were sitting in the lawn chairs when I came home. They were shooting across a public road. They had gone across my yard to get to my hill road so that they could drive deer over the edge, and they had a little boy with them teaching them Wisconsin hunting traditions. You guys really need to talk about fair chase and, and getting out and walking.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Judy, that's a very, very good comment. Just a couple things quickly. I'm not aware of any seasons that start in August here in Wisconsin. I know dove season starts September 1st, and I think that's the earliest fall season. Then we get into waterfowl and turkey, and pheasant just opened last Saturday. And bow hunting for deer starts middle of September usually and runs beyond Christmas. Then we have other seasons like that. But you are absolutely right, and a lot of people who hunt would be very appalled at those kind of behaviors, and a lot of people who hunt police themselves, because the kind of hunters you just described give hunting a bad name, and hunting in general is becoming less and less publicly accepted as a very valuable management tool in the wildlife field. And if you see things like that, we would strongly encourage you to either call your local police office or certainly call the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources Conservation Wardens, and they'll come out and investigate, and if they can find them, and they are actually doing something that is against the law or against regulations, they will get cited for that and have to pay a fine at the minimum, and depending on how egregious it is, may have to appear before court. So please do not hesitate to call law enforcement on behavior that you see as illegal.
Mm-hmm. Dan, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Carl in Greenleaf, let's turn to you next. Hi, Carl.
Hi. I have a concern about wind turbines and eagles in the state of Wisconsin. And there's a company by the name of Emerging Energies that is applying to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service for a take permit to kill 4 to 5 bald eagles in the operation of a wind project they have proposed for the town of Forest in St. Croix County over in the western part of the state. And it's going to consist of 41 500-foot industrial wind turbines. And I believe you work as a biological consultant to that company, and I was wondering what your take is on how well a breeding population of eagles can sustain itself in the presence of that many 500-foot wind towers.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for calling.
Well, Carl, yeah, thank you very much for that question. And you're right. I've just completed a one-year pre-construction study out there in Forest in St. Croix County for Emerging Energies. And we did an avian study looking at all types of birds that are in that area. And we also did a bat study with ultrasonic bat detectors called anabats to try to understand what bat species are in that area. And when I guess about 2 weeks ago, I had to go to the Public Service Commission over here in Madison to testify on behalf of the wind farm that was going in at St. Croix County, and I was rather surprised when I showed up that morning that there were probably 30 protesters out on all four corners of the intersection, vocally in opposition of that wind farm. And Wind energy is being touted as a green energy source and an alternative energy source, and obviously now with the some of the political issues going on, it's in the news front and center. And right or wrong, green energy has also become very controversial. There's a number of people who have health concerns from that, and there's also concerns to flying wildlife. So, to your pertinent question, Carl, about eagles. I did testify to the Public Service Commission about eagles, and that is a topic that was of great interest to the Public Service Commission. And it is possible, based on some of the modeling, that between 1 in 5 bald eagles could be killed each year there from wind turbines. Personally and professionally, I don't think that's going to happen because looking at the literature, scientific mm-hmm. literature, no bald eagle has been documented to have been killed as a result of wind energy, the operation of wind turbines. But the other issue is in the off chance that 1 or even 5 bald eagles do get killed a year, the eagle population appears to be very, very healthy over in the St. Croix River Valley, and partly because they've just got outstanding eagle habitat over there. So my professional opinion is that even though one or a number of individual eagles may get killed as a result of the wind farm being built, and that would be unfortunate, obviously, for those individual eagles, my professional opinion is that the eagle population overall can sustain that mortality because they've got a lot of nesting eagles over there, and my belief is that the recruitment will be able to compensate for any mortality.
There we go. Thanks a lot, Carl, for calling. Appreciate it. We have an email question from Susan in Lone Rock who says, I have a woodchuck living under my deck. Any way to discourage him to move on or encourage him to move on, I think is what she means. I can't crawl under there. Are there plants or certain scents to get rid of him? Oh, they're miserable to get rid of one. Tell you?
Yeah, woodchucks, they're also called groundhogs, and occasionally you'll hear them referred to as whistle pigs. So groundhogs are a hibernating species, Susan. Soon they should be going underground into the burrow for the winter months, and they probably won't come back up above ground until at least the end of March or so, maybe April, even like that. So one thing you can do is just wait them out, and eventually they're going to go underground for the next few months. You won't have to deal with them. If you want to try to deal with it before hibernation, you can get a live trap that is large enough to fit the groundhog into, and then set that open live trap next to one of the burrow openings, and preferably the burrow opening that has the amount of soil in front of it. That is an indication that that's the primary burrow opening or entrance exit. So set the live trap open right next to that burrow entrance, and you can bait the trap with if you take some apple and quarter the apple and then possibly put a little bit of imitation French vanilla on each quarter of apple, or if you take plum tomatoes and bait it with plum tomatoes. You can also use cold crops like lettuce or a cabbage or something like that. But you can try to capture that animal, and if you do, you are legal on your property to kill the animal when it's causing damage, as long as the method you use to kill the animal is legal in the municipality in which you reside. You're also able to relocate or move that animal to a different piece of property. If you release it on private property, however, you need to have the property owner's permission if you do not own that private property. Mm-hmm. And ideally, on public lands, you should have the manager of that public lands permission. So you can try that. The other issue that sometimes you can try is to literally gas or fumigate the animal. And in order to do that, you would have to find all of the burrow openings, seal all of them up by putting a plug of grass in there or fill them up with soil or whatever you want. That last burrow opening, you would ignite the gas charge, drop it into the burrow, and then seal that last opening. And it is a very humane way to euthanize the animal. One thing about using those gas charges, however, if it is under your deck or near a house, that possibly the gas could seep into your house. And some of those charges are similar to a flare, so you actually have to light them, and they smoke, and they also have a flame attached to it. And there is a fire hazard. So if you do use gas, especially near your house, I would just caution you to be very, very careful about that.
And thanks very much for that question, Susan. Appreciate it. Well, we have a winner in the contest with a quiz question. What is the maximum number of wolves that will be harvested during the 2012-2013 wolf hunt in Wisconsin? The answer is 116. The quota for the season is 201, but the harvest of 85 wolves have have been given to the native tribes, and they're vowed to not harvest any of their given quota. So it's going to be 116.
Yep, that's exactly right. And Meridia, I'm thrilled that you got the answer, but I'm disappointed because I was hoping that eventually we're gonna stump Larry's audience in one of these questions. And I thought maybe this was the question, but well done.
And she's from Lone Rock, Meridia B. from Lone Rock. Eight people got the correct answer, by the way.
Well, that's even more disappointing.
I mean, so she won the drawing. So there you have it. You can join in with a question or comment as we talk about the world of wildlife today with David Drake, wildlife specialist with UW Extension, associate professor of forest and wildlife ecology at UW-Madison. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking wildlife today with the wildlife specialist David Drake from the UW-Madison. Larry Mueller here. Thank you for listening in. And Dan in Belgium has a comment. Dan, hi. Thank you for calling.
Larry, this is Dan Small. Hi to you and to David.
Hi, Dan.
I thought I'd call in and remind you and your listeners that the annual Deer Hunt Wisconsin TV special, it's the hour-long show that I do every year with folks from the DNR. It's going to air next Thursday night, November 1st, on public television throughout the state.
Next Thursday night, November 1st. And what's the time on it? We have a time?
8 o'clock on Thursday night on Milwaukee Public TV. That's Channel 10. And the state network airs the show on the Wisconsin Digital Channel, which is the .2 channel.
Yep.
So 21.2. So 8 o'clock Thursday for both of those airings. And then Milwaukee will repeat the show at 9 a.m. on Saturday. And then the following week, a shorter version of the show, because we had to add commercials, will air on Fox Sports North and Fox Sports Wisconsin. Right after the Minnesota Wild hockey game, if the NHL lockout ends. Otherwise, it airs at 7. So it's 9 o'clock or after the game or 7 o'clock, and they're repeating that show on Sunday.
It's always a great show, and Dan, and it must be fun to put it together.
It certainly is, and it's a lot of work, but it is a real joy to work, as you know, with folks from the DNR. And this year, we're looking at research, forest management for tree sustained yield and for wildlife, recruitment and retention of hunters. And we've got some great stories of hunters' first successful deer hunt, including Kathy Stepp's first deer from last season and a couple of other real surprises. So I think this is the best show. We've done 21 of them, and we just finished the public version yesterday. And it's being dubbed today, and I think, of course, I'm biased, but I think it's the best one we've done yet, so I hope folks enjoy it.
Well, thanks a lot. I think I haven't seen every one. I missed a couple over the years, but that's always a really good program, and I always look forward to it.
It'll be archived also on the DNR website. In fact, there is a page there right now. If you just type in the keywords deer show, you get a preview of what's on it, and as soon as the show airs, I believe they're going to have video right on that site.
And also all of the times and so forth will be there as well.
Right.
Yeah. Dan, thank you so much.
You bet. Great show, Larry.
All right. Dan Small, who has hosted that program for all those years, and it really is a good program, David.
It is a great program, and I know it gets a bunch of people fired up if they're not already for deer season. So, absolutely.
Karen in Plymouth has a question. Karen, hi.
Good morning.
Morning.
Could you discuss the rules for trapping on public lands, specifically, marking of the traps and things like that? I own property in northern Wisconsin and do a lot of hiking with my dog and like to hike on public lands, but I like to bushwhack and go off trail, and I'm just concerned about the trapping and getting my dog or myself caught in a trap. If you could discuss that, please.
Sure.
Yeah, I sure will, Karen. And let me also, not only for you but for everybody else, just mention that the rules for the wolf harvest season right now can be relatively fluid because there are court challenges and things of that nature. So I'm gonna give everybody a website currently, and what I would encourage everybody to do, because the rules are also rather changing. Long and they're changing, and just so that everybody's aware of the current rules, and if you are especially if you have a license to harvest a wolf, I would encourage you to check these rules every time before you go out, just to make sure that you are legal in what you're doing. But the website is DNR, for the Department of Natural Resources, so dnr.wi.gov. And there's a search engine. You can type in the keyword in the search engine, and all you have to type in is wolf, W-O-L-F. And they've got a website that is updating the wolf harvest numbers every day and the zones and things like that. So I would encourage everybody to go to that. Specifically to your question, for people to go out and trap, and typically for trapping wolves, is usually going to either be a leg hold trap or a cable restraint trap. Leg hold traps are, as they sound, that the animal steps into the trap, they touch the pan or the trigger, and then jaws surround the leg, and they mm-hmm. hold the animal there until the trapper comes back. For any trap that's open on the land, by law, you have to check that trap at least once every 24 hours. Most of the traps that trappers are using these days are not the old traps that a lot of people think of as these mm-hmm. barbaric, inhumane traps. That Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources and John Olson, the fur bearer biologist with DNR, they were involved in a national, what's called best management practice study to look at humane ways of trapping animals. And the traps that are being employed these days are very, very humane to those animals, and as humane as you can make them. Most of the time that your dog, as long as you've got your dog within reach of you or within call of you, and your dog will respond to you, that if you can just keep the dog close to you, most of the time those traps are not going to be set on trails that people are using, because the wolves are not also going to necessarily use those trails regularly, or they may not use those trails regularly. So if you keep the dog next to you or close to you, either on a leash or within voice command, you should be okay. In the off chance or the unfortunate chance that your dog gets trapped into a leg hold trap, it is relatively easy to spread those jaws open, and you can release your dog. And the dog, again, with the traps that are being used these days, the dog is likely the dog would not have a broken leg. It may have some skin damage. The skin may have opened up just like a cut. But most likely your dog will not suffer irreparable damage or anything of that nature, and it will not do any permanent damage to the leg. If it's a cable restraint trap, that is essentially airplane wire, mm-hmm. and on cable restraints, they're required to have a stop on that cable restraint, so that as the animal fights against that cable restraint trap, and cable restraints are meant that the animal will put its head through the noose of the cable restraint, and as it goes and pulls against that cable restraint, the noose tightens, but that stop prevents the cable restraint from tightening so tight that it chokes the animal. And again, if it's a cable restraint trap that your dog gets into, which would be more unlikely, all you would need to do is to loosen that stop, and then you can just pull that cable restraint back over the dog's head.
There we go. Thank you very much for that question. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. Or you can post on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. We'd love to hear from you. The DNR is 3 years into a 5-year deer study, David. I'm pretty sure you're familiar with this study. What are they hoping to get data on?
Well, they are trying to find out fawn mortality, so fawn predation, and they're also mm-hmm. trying to find out buck mortality and age of the buck at the time of mortality. And they're into, I think, the third of 5 years now. And just as a side note, when Dr. Kroll came in to the state to audit the deer program, this was one of the things that he suggested, is that research needs to occur looking at a couple of these variables. And the DNR was very proactive and had started this research program long before Dr. Kroll came into the state and made this recommendation. But one of my former graduate students, Mike Watt, is leading the field part of this trial out there. And Tim mm-hmm. Van Dielen, a professor in our department, is associated with this study, as are a number of people at the DNR. So it's a joint collaborative project between the DNR and University of Wisconsin-Madison. Mm-hmm. And many of the landowners that are out there in the northern part of the state and the eastern part of the state where these two study sites are. But essentially what they've done and currently have on the landscape, they've got about 240 deer that have a radio collar around their neck. And then they've got about another 200 deer that do not have a radio collar, but they've got ear tags in their ear. And the DNR is not necessarily encouraging you to go and seek these deer out to harvest them or shoot them. But if you are, if you've got the opportunity to shoot a deer and you see it has a radio collar on it or is an ear tag in it, please do not shy away from shooting that deer. Okay. Because this will be very valuable data and information for the DNR and this larger study. So if you do shoot a deer during this deer season that has either a radio collar around the neck or the ear tag, and the ear tag will be prominent and it'll be obvious. Absolutely. Yeah. So if you do shoot a deer that either has a radio collar or an ear tag, please call Mike Watt at 608-221-6376. And the information they're asking you to report is either the ear tag or the radio collar number. And that should be, again, rather obvious. But if you get a hold of Mike on the phone, Mike can also talk you through about where to find that information on either the collar or the tag. The other piece of information they would like to know is how, when, and where the animal died or was harvested. So it doesn't mean just that if you harvest a deer, but if you are walking through the woods and you find a dead deer that has either a radio collar or ear tag, please call that in as well. And then finally, if you do not get a hold of Mike and you leave a voicemail, please leave your number with the area code included.
All right. There we go. So,
great. And thank you very much for doing that.
Chris in Madison. Hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi there. I have a question about skunks. Sorry, there's noise here in the background. We have a skunk that's been hanging around our house, and we live in the city. And now our dog has gotten skunk on her 2 days in a row.
Oh.
And wondering if you have any suggestions for how we can dispense or discourage the skunk from hanging around. We do have chickens in our yard, so I don't know if it might be hanging around hoping for chicken eggs or something like that.
Okay, and Chris, getting rid of the dog is not an option, I take it?
No, but she's right. But she is pretty smelly right
now.
Actually, there's some scent. We can talk about getting the scent off, too.
Yeah, if you don't have a good solution to bathe your dog in, if you just go to Google or any other search engine and just type in, you know, skunk spray and odor removal, a number of recipes will come up that are usually
pretty good. There's one that's really good, and we've got it up on our Facebook page somewhere.
So maybe we can repost that.
Yeah, we can repost. Judith can repost that.
I think it's the baking soda and hydrogen peroxide one.
Yes, that's the one.
There's one with that. There's one with the ingredient of tomato juice and lemon, and there's a number of recipes out there, so you might have to try a couple of them, and you also may have to bathe your dog a number of times, it sounds like. But obviously, so skunks are very, very common both in the rural areas, but they're also very, very common in suburban city-type areas as well.
Uh-huh.
And they're primarily nocturnal. One thing about skunks is that they are, depending on the year, they are one of the more common carriers of rabies. So if you if you interact with a skunk, just be careful that you don't get either bit or scratched. But again, a skunk that's active at night and looks healthy is going to want to get away from you as fast as you want to get away from it. So typically that's not going to be an issue for a healthy skunk. One thing is figure out why the skunk's coming in. And if you have chickens, you've got chicken eggs, that would be a good reason why the skunk might be coming in there because it may be trying to get access to those chicken eggs to eat them. So you may want to just make sure that the skunk cannot get to the eggs or to any other attractants. So if you're feeding, for example, your dog outside, bring the dog food inside so the skunk can't get to that. The other thing you can do, you can put a live trap out for the skunk, and again, get a live trap that is large enough that the skunk can fit into. And if you have an idea about where the skunk is traveling in your yard, try to put that trap in the area where you've seen the skunk. Bait the trap with a can of wet cat food. And so you open that can up, just leave the top off of it, put the can in the trap, and very likly you could have that skunk trapped by the next morning. If you what's that?
Would that be the same as a squirrel trap, similar or same?
Typically squirrel traps are a little bit smaller, so you probably want a trap that's a little bit bigger than a squirrel trap. And so you probably are looking for a medium-sized Havrehard or Tomahawk live trap.
Okay.
And then if you do catch the skunk, when the next question is, what do I do with it? And so if you do catch the skunk, go out into your yard. Make sure the skunk is aware that you're there. So you don't want to yell and make loud, frantic noises and actions. But make sure the skunk is aware you're there. And as long as the skunk knows you're there and you approach the trap slowly, you can take a old piece of canvas or blanket or towel or whatever you have and just cover that trap up and encase it so that it's dark inside that trap. And that darkness or darkening that trap is going to calm that skunk down immediately. Mm-hmm. And once you've got that skunk calmed down, then you can move that trap. And again, you're welcome to kill the animal if you want to, as long as the method you use to kill it is legal within the city in which you reside. You can relocate that animal. And similar comments that I made with the groundhog is if you put it on private property you don't own, make sure you have the private property owner's permission. Public land, you can put it out there as long as you've got the manager of the public land's permission. The other possibility is that you try to prevent the skunk from coming into your yard. And so you could try fencing and things like that. Skunks are not great diggers, but if the soil is organic enough, they can certainly dig under the fence. So you could try that as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, and Chris, stay listening. Clarence in Watertown has something that relates to this as well, I believe. Clarence, hi. Thank you for calling.
Good morning, gentlemen. Yes, we did that. We put the live trap in the ground. We're on the dairy farm. Put the live trap in the garage trying to catch the woodchucks that have been, running around. And lo and behold, we caught about a medium-sized skunk in the trap in the garage. So I did exactly what, I put an old parka over the trap, picked it up, skunk and all, put it on the tailgate of the truck, took it about a mile or so down to our next farm down by the river, and then carefully opened the door, propped the door of the live trap open, and got away from there. And about 10 seconds, the little guy waddled out and down into the ditch, and away he went.
Uh-huh.
And so I'm hoping I did the right thing. I mean, I looked at him in the trap, and I just couldn't bear to shoot him. He looked so fuzzy kitty cat sitting there. And I have shot him in the live trap before, and they spray instantly.
They do, and there's a lot of anecdotes out there about where exactly you should shoot a skunk to not make it spray, and I've heard in the head and in the spine and everything else, and I'm not sure that there's any proven way to necessarily shoot a skunk and not have it spray you. But Clarence, it sounds like you did everything correct, and if you don't mind, I'm gonna advertise your number statewide. Anybody has a skunk problem, you can help them from now on.
The old parka that I threw over the cage, it did smell, but not real strongly.
Yeah.
He did release a little bit, but not a heck of a lot, because there was no residue on the tailgate of the truck or in the trap. But, my wife took the old parka and burned it. So,
okay.
One thing about that parka, and when we trap animals, if we're live trapping animals, a lot of times we'll cover the animal's eyes with a blindfold, not only to protect the eyes, but when animals are encased in darkness or they can't see, that calms them down considerably. And so that parka, or encasing that trap in darkness, has a calming effect on animals, and that's the right way to go about it, Clarence. You did a great job.
That was kind of my understanding, and I tried that, and it worked very, very well. And I don't know how beneficial the skunks are or are not, but they're not a real problem around the dairy farm. The raccoons and the woodchucks are worse on the silage bags.
Yep.
And
small rodents as well.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah.
Thanks, Clarence.
Okay. Sure.
Yeah, appreciate the call.
Larry, I know, I'm sure you've heard this story. I think it was a friend of Scott Craven's, had a skunk in a trap and called Scott, and Scott said, do exactly that. Walk out, make sure the skunk is aware you're there, and cover it with a tarp or something like that. And so that I believe it was Scott's friend. Went to do that, and as he's trying to cover the trap with the tarp, he trips on the tarp, which causes him to fall into the trap, and the skunk starts spraying and everything. And so you just make sure you have some kind of a covering that is not long enough and you're going to trip on it.
Oh, man. David Drake, wildlife specialist with UW Extension, associate professor of forest and wildlife ecology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, our guest here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for listening in. Talking the World of Wildlife today with David Drake from the UW-Madison. Larry Mueller here. Thanks so much for listening in. Some photos on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. We've got turkeys for sure. There's well the bear.
Those turkeys.
I've got the got a flock of turkeys, and it looks like, is that another flock of turkeys?
Or geese, maybe.
That's a harder one to tell.
Oh, no, it is turkeys. It looks like turkeys.
So a couple of turkey shots, and then an animal that we having a hard time identifying simply because it was a game camera at night, and we don't have the head. You can't see the head.
Well, I'm looking at that game camera in the lower right-hand corner. It looks like it's taken at 4 a.m. in the morning on June 14th of 2012. And from the looks of it, it's kind of a blurry animal, and there's some grass seed heads that are blocking part of that animal in the fore picture. But it looks to me like the animal, the head of the animal, or the animal is moving from left to right across the screen of that camera, and is in Brooklyn, Wisconsin, which is just south of Madison. So from the size of that animal in Brooklyn, Wisconsin, I'm going to suggest it's possibly a coyote.
Okay.
But certainly, if you've got other ideas, call in or email in, and this would be a great discussion topic.
Yeah, I'm having trouble figuring that one out myself. And if you have a question or comment, I'd love to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. Or go to my Facebook page. You could post there at the Larry Mueller Show. And again, we'd love to hear from you. So give us a call with your wildlife question or comment. And a lot of hunting seasons actually are about underway or are underway or getting underway.
Yep, that's right. The turkey season and waterfowl seasons. The bow hunting for deer has been going on. The youth deer gun hunt was the first weekend of October. Obviously, the 9-day gun season is coming up that Saturday before Thanksgiving. Pheasant just opened last Saturday. Dove opened September 1st. And so, obviously, and then you've got an assortment of small game seasons going on as well. So, it is. It's a very, very busy time and a time a lot of people look forward to.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a beautiful, beautiful out there now.
It is.
Across a good part of the state here, we still got a lot of color in the woods.
I'm surprised at that, especially down here in the southern part of the state. I thought the trees would be so drought-stressed from this summer that they would just drop their leaves. But we actually had a pretty decent fall foliage season here.
Yep, absolutely. Doug in McQuantico, we'll turn to you next. Hi, Doug. Thank you for calling.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
I'm just curious, is this an up year for squirrels? Because I'm telling you, I'm lousy with squirrels. I've lived out of my house for, 19 years now, and I've never seen so many squirrels. And it seems like I see a lot crossing the road, a lot of them squished out in the road. Do squirrels go in cycles like grouse or rabbits and stuff like that too?
Doug, that's a good question and a common question about our species, up this year, down this year, populations up or down. And unfortunately, it's a hard question to answer. With squirrels, there's not a ton of census data or information about the number of squirrels out there. But a couple of things that usually I'll tell people when they say, hey, are things up or down this year? Number one is for some reason or other, perhaps you're just more observant this year and you're seeing more squirrels because you're looking for them. Once you start looking for them, you start finding more possibly. So that's a possibility. Squirrels are in the rodent, is a type of rodent, and rodents are pretty prolific breeders, and they can go up and down over a given year or in between, over the course of years as well. And sometimes last winter we had a relatively mild winter here in the south, and that sometimes cold sustained winters can knock populations down a little bit, and when we don't have real cold winters, it gives those populations a little bit of a leg up. And then obviously with squirrels being nut eaters and consisting on a lot of hard mass like acorns, when we get years of good acorn mass, that sometimes we've got animals that increase in numbers simply because the food is there to support those increased numbers. So you very well could be, Doug, that in your area squirrels could be up this year, and for any of the reasons I mentioned and perhaps some reasons I didn't mention.
Yeah.
So I'm sorry. I was just going to say, I'm sorry I can't be more more definitive.
Yeah, when I look out my front window and I see six squirrels crouching around my bird feeder, I've never seen more than one or two out there. And when you see six, and then I see six out there, and then I go down the driveway and there's four or five more running around there. It's
That's a lot.
I don't know if it was a dry year If there's more nuts for them to eat, maybe it was a mild winter last year. But it just seems to be there's a lot of squirrels.
It's a really good year for acorns.
It is a good year for acorns. And you know, at least here in the South, where we had so much drought, that I do think it drove a lot of animals closer to where people live because they were looking for water and looking for food. And so I think that we probably had more interactions either visually or physically with wildlife simply because the wildlife were being driven closer to humans than in a normal precipitation year. So that could also account for some of what you're seeing.
Mm-hmm. Hey, thanks a lot, guys.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, appreciate
the call. Good
question.
Thank you.
Kevin in Mondovi. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
I live in the north, I guess it'd be east corner of Buffalo County, and I was in the woods the other day and saw what I think is a fisher, and I was just wondering how common they are to this area.
Kevin, remind me where Buffalo County is in the state.
Pardon me?
Remind me what part of the state Buffalo County
is in. It's 16 miles south of Eau Claire.
Okay, yep. Yeah, so... that's
it's one of the biggest whitetail.
Yeah.
yep. Okay. So, obviously, fishers are typically thought of as a northern forested species and use forests that are larger in tree size and kind of more of a climax type forest. But we are seeing more and more fishers pushing south, and there are a lot of animals that use that kind of Mississippi River Valley area in the western part of the state. That they can range south with relative ease because there's a lot of good habitat that's connected through there, and they can kind of skirt around some of the human populations and things of that nature. And so we are seeing getting rather common accounts of fishers down south into southern Wisconsin, or even around Minneapolis-St. Paul, the Twin Cities over in Minneapolis. So it is very, very possible you saw a fisher. They are a relatively decent-sized animal. I mean, maybe the size of a medium-sized dog or a little bit smaller. But the one of the real big identifying characteristics of fishers, obviously, is that very, very big, bushy, dark tail that you see on them. Yep. And that tail is makes up for a good portion of the overall length of that animal. And frankly, I wouldn't be too terribly surprised if in years down the line that we may actually kind of redefine what exactly kind of habitat fishers need, and we may actually give them more credit for being more flexible in their habitat requirements and being more adaptable to living in and around human populations than we currently define them as now. So it is very, very possible you saw a fisher.
Could you tell me what their diet is?
Yeah, it's primarily other mammals, so small mammals like chipmunks, smaller rodents, squirrels, things like that. They will, up in the northern part of the state, they will eat martens as well. And fishers are one of the few animals that can also eat porcupine without injuring themselves.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, are they dark brown or are they black?
Typically they're black, but they can, their pelage color can range a little bit. But typically it's more into the dark color. So, dark brown to a black.
Yeah, it was about the size of a big raccoon with the big bushy tail.
Yep.
Yeah.
That sounds like it.
Thanks a lot for calling, Kevin. Carl has something relating to fishers, I believe. Hi, Carl.
Yeah, it's really ironic that this call was just before. When we were coming back from Milwaukee last spring, just outside of Madison, on those areas where those fields are dotted along the road on the north side, I looked up through there, and there looked like a fisher there feeding on a dead deer type of thing. We're, freeway, but still, I'd seen one in the woods up here in Black River where we lived, and I think there was one there. I was going to call the DNR at that time, and I never did, but so I think I saw one there.
Yeah, you possibly could have. I got an email, I guess maybe 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks mm-hmm. ago, from somebody who lives here in Madison over by the University of Wisconsin Arboretum, which is kind of on the, just over by the Beltline, south central Madison. And she said that she swore her neighbor saw a fisher as well. And, I mean, it's possible. So they are starting to range south, and they're starting to move a little bit out of the north. And the population, as far as I'm aware, is doing pretty well up in the northern part of the state.
Hmm. Okay. There you go. Thank you, Carl, for calling. Appreciate your call. Conrad had an email wondering, lives outside of Genoa City, lots of chipmunks on the property. the acre property that they have. Any idea how many chipmunks might live in an individual burrow or a setting where you've got three or four main burrows?
You know what? I think the last piece of scientific data I saw was 3.4 chipmunks per burrow or something like that. So, no, you know, that's a joke. Conrad, I don't know exactly how many chipmunks live in a burrow offhand, but they are a social animal, and there are multiple individuals that do live and occupy burrows. So I'm not sure exactly how many. It's not like a common mole, for example, M-O-L-E, that have that underground tunnel system, and they're a solitary animal within that mm-hmm. tunnel system. But chipmunks, there can be numbers of individuals within that burrow system. And if you need some help getting rid of the chipmunks or stopping any damage, certainly let us know, and we can provide the information on that.
Yeah, there can be quite a few on a
yeah. Yeah, if you start trapping chipmunks out of that burrow, you know, you set a trap around one burrow, you can catch multiple chipmunks before you have to
for
move
sure.
that trap.
David Drake, wildlife specialist with the UW Extension and the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at the UW-Madison, our guest as we talk wildlife here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Many of us who live in Wisconsin count our amazing wildlife as one of our great treasures. And whether you're new to wildlife watching or maybe been watching wildlife your whole life, great to have people who know and care about our environment to talk with us about those wildlife. Larry Mueller here. So glad you could join us today on the Ideas Network. My guest today, David Drake from the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology, our guest until 12:30 today. So if you've been wondering where you might be able to see a particular animal or a bird or even an insect, that'd be something to talk about. I hope you'll join us at 1-800-642-1234. Don't forget to visit our Facebook page. You can leave a question there, post a comment, or maybe even a wildlife photo. We've had some nice ones entered in the Facebook page already today. Click like while you're there. We'll send you regular updates on upcoming show topics. We'll be back right after the news. Taking a look at the world of wildlife today with David Drake, wildlife specialist with UW Extension and the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW. And David, thanks again for coming by today. Appreciate it very much.
You're welcome.
We have caller Mary in Madison wondering about tree frogs. What's their life cycle like? Do they freeze over the winter?
They do, yeah. All amphibians and reptiles have to go in some kind of a hibernation phase to survive the cold winters up here and really anywhere above the freeze line in the United States. Tree frogs, let me back up. Frogs in general are just kind of interesting to begin with,
yeah.
That they can survive. But there's a couple of different frog species. Spring peeper is one of them. Where as they right before they go into hibernation, they'll actually will kind of ramp up their metabolism. They produce this like, almost like a glycol like substance, or almost like antifreeze, and that kind of floods their body. And then they freeze solid, and they cease breathing, and they really essentially yeah. cease most life functions. And then they thaw out in the spring, and they keep on going. Other frogs will burrow down into their sandy substrate soil and just burrow beneath the soil where there's enough insulation they can ride out the winter and not freeze. And other frogs will go below the water, go into the water,
yeah.
And when the water freezes, they will just hang out where the water is not frozen and kind of breathe through their skin. So,
yeah.
For the tree frogs, it's most likely that they're not necessarily an aquatic species, that they will go and burrow into loose soil or kind of a sandy substrate and ride out the winter beneath the ground.
Matt in Green Bay wonders, this is in the northern half of the state, it seems like a large number of the migrating land birds have already come through, and the wooded areas are quieting down a little bit. Outside of shorelines and marsh areas, are there other spots you recommend birding in November and December?
That's a good question. And, I know we've been talking about hunting a lot this show because of the fall hunting seasons. But, you know, another wonderful thing about the fall is you get an opportunity to see some birds migrating through here that
yeah.
you normally wouldn't see. And so even though the birds aren't in our area, you know, for the spring nesting season, they fly further north, but they will stop over here for a day or maybe a week on their journey south, and then they reverse the pattern again in the spring. So you might see a bay-breasted warbler, you might see blackpoll warblers, palm warblers, you know, Tennessee warblers, which normally you wouldn't see. I was just on the Wisconsin Birding Network, and somebody saw a western grebe in Lake Michigan, which is an unusual species for here. Somebody saw and heard snow geese flying overhead. So this really is a neat, neat time of the year for observations like that, to see some birds you normally wouldn't see. But, you know, of the roughly 400 bird species we've got in the state of Wisconsin, about 85% of those species are migratory, and so they're not in our state come November and December. And so we're left with the state resident species, and any good spot that you normally would find birds would be a good spot in November, December. So obviously, if there's open water, it's a great spot. Marshes, forested areas, grassland areas, areas where you have habitat types that come together, such as a forest and a shrubland, where those habitat types meet, is a good place. And, you know, don't overlook suburban areas. There's a lot of fragmentation in suburban areas, and with that fragmentation, you get a lot of habitat diversity, and because of that, you get a lot of bird diversity.
Speaking of diversity, what about black bears? David was wondering how many black bears we have living in Wisconsin right now, or roughly.
Well, I think that's up for debate. You know, I think initially, a number of years ago, the DNR, I believe, kind of estimated the population of roughly maybe 13,000, give or take a little bit. And then we had a graduate student in our department, David McFarland, who worked with Professor Tim Van Dielen. And David did this, you know, very, very well done mark recapture study, and he, I think he estimated that there may be as close to 39,000 bears in the state of Wisconsin. David has now since finished his PhD and is a biologist up in the northern part of the state for the DNR with the research section, and they are replicating that study he just did to try to get a better handle on the estimate. So I'll let you know it's probably between 13,000 and maybe roughly 40,000, and stay tuned.
We'll learn it.
Numbers may come in the near future here.
We have Beverly in Rushford up next with a question. Hi, Beverly.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
Well, I have got quite a collection of red squirrels or pine squirrels, as someone told me they were. I've got a lot of walnut trees around, and they are storing up quite a collection of walnuts in my roof and in my ceilings and and wherever they can find, and they're very beautiful animals. Now, I have a Have-A-Heart trap out with peanut butter in it, and because I'm told they love peanut butter, and I have an ultrasound machine that I managed to get into my walls up above on the second floor, and still and then all my bird life has gone. Every single thing that I love to see has gone because of the rattlesnake noise that the ultrasound puts out, which seems to permeate the property outside, too.
Beverly, let me ask you a question about your trap. Is your trap set inside your house where the squirrels are, or is it outside the house?
Outside.
Okay. And you do have squirrels inside your house, though?
Well, they're in the walls.
Okay.
So far.
So one thing I would suggest is to take that trap and actually put it inside of your house. And I would go put it up in your attic and make sure that the squirrels can get to it so that they have access from your walls into your attic. And also the one thing you need to do is you go up there, and if you have access to the walls, take as many of those walnuts and food sources out of the area as you possibly can, because that will make that will drive the squirrels to your bait. If you don't do that, they don't have much incentive to go to your bait because they've got plenty of food laying around in the attic and the walls. And so, and I would also probably get rid of the ultrasonic device. That if it's been ongoing and the squirrels are still there, that's probably an indication that it's not effective, and it's probably causing you more kind of just
grief
than anything else. So,
yeah,
so stop the ultrasonic device. I would remove that. I would move your trap inside the house. Up into the attic.
Here's one bad thing. There is no attic.
Okay.
And what I had to do is dig my way through a wallboard and try to find with my hand some place that I could place that ultrasound device. And then it seems to rattle through the house at different times, just all the time. I've had it on all the time for about a week now. Now, I've got a lot of walnuts stored here and there. where I can't see.
Right.
That they're stored. What do I do about them?
So can you isolate in the wall roughly where the squirrels are?
Well, they're pretty aggressive. I would say where I've got the ultrasound right now is right over my kitchen sink.
Okay.
And that's where I'm hearing them, and it's like a bowling alley up there sometimes.
Yeah.
Boy, well, they really go to work.
So a couple of things. If you can get into the wall space, and actually if there's enough space inside the walls to set a trap or a number of traps, I would do that. The other thing that is really vitally important is that you figure out how they're getting into the house or into the walls.
Yeah.
And simultaneous with you trapping, you need to seal that up and prevent any more access from that area. The other thing you can possibly do, if you cannot get traps into the wall space, the other thing you can do, you can go online, or if you call a pest control operator in your Yellow Pages, you can find a wildlife pest control operator. Find what's called a one-way excluder device. And the areas where the squirrels are accessing, you need to seal all those areas up but that last one area. Put the one-way excluder device over that hole, and as the squirrels are eventually going to be driven out of your wall because they're going to have to seek more food. And as they do that, they're going to push out that one-way excluder device, but they're not going to be able to get back in. And I would leave the device on your house for maybe up to a week. That should be enough time to make sure they're all out. And after that, you can take that device off and then seal that last hole up, and you should be good to go.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. It's a little bit of work ahead of you, Beverly, but it'll work. It'll work. Diane, who's in Upper Michigan, I believe. Hi, Diane.
Yes, we have been driving through Wisconsin and just enjoying your program, but I had heard about the squirrels a little earlier and wanted to caution people about the red squirrel because it was proven that a red squirrel is the cause of my brother's fire, which he lost everything. And I've heard a couple of others about fires with the red squirrel. Also, my husband set a tote down probably about 20 minutes, and we went back to get it. We had noticed the squirrel was running over the top of it, but we didn't pay attention that much. And when we came back, there was a very large hole eaten in the top of it, so they can go through pretty fast.
Yep, squirrels, again, are a rodent, and with all rodents, they're just incredible chewers and gnawers and all that. And I'm guessing, Diane, that just for all the callers' interest, that the reason the fire started is not just because it's a red squirrel, but it's because they're chewing through the electrical wires in the house.
That's what it was. It chewed through the wires, yes.
Yep. Yeah. That. And that can be true for anything that's chewing on wires. You want to obviously be careful about that.
Yes.
Thank you, Diane. Appreciate it. It's a good reminder. And Dick in Waukesha, your turn. Hi, Dick.
Well, I worked for the Forest Service, and I was in Watersmeet, Michigan, when the Forest Service decided to quit shooting porcupines and introduce the fisher. And we had about three shipments of maybe a dozen or wild trapped in Superior, I think. And we had a wildlife biologist working for us, and we were to weigh them and put a clip in the ear and get the gender. Well, when all of us got bitten, including the wildlifer, we decided the heck with all that. We figured out how to weigh them, but we weren't going to do the other. And so I know I think all the other forests, the Hiawatha and the Shumwamigan, the Nicolet, the hardwood forests, maybe. So we heard later on that there were fisher galore, and not many porcupines anymore. What's the status of the porcupine?
Well, if you go up north, the porcupines are rather common. I'm not sure how many there are and the status of, but I'm just from my own observations and seen a number of them. I think the porcupine population is rather healthy. We've got another professor in our department, Dr. John Pauly, who's got a graduate student over in Nisida, the Sandhill area, and he's actually doing a porcupine study right now. So they're marking porcupines and radio collaring them and tracking them around and looking at mortality and length of life and things like that. So hopefully when that study comes out, we'll know even more than we do now.
Fisher is numerous, too?
Yeah, Fisher seem to be very healthy in terms of numbers. Absolutely.
Yep.
Well, and been there and balanced.
Hopefully. Thanks, Dick.
You're welcome.
Yeah, appreciate the call. Jennifer in Westfield. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hi, David.
Hi, Jennifer.
I have another Fisher question. I was really excited. My husband and I set up a trail camera over a deer carcass and got three really nice pictures of a Fisher in Westfield, Wisconsin, in the middle of the Oak Barrens, an area that we have a lot of standing dead timber from oak wilts. And I sent the pictures to Scott Craven, and he said, yes, those are Fisher, or one Fisher.
Okay.
So I was just wondering about, we leave the standing dead timber for the red-headed woodpeckers that are also on the property, and I was wondering if Fishers are maybe expanding ranges south, because they do like a lot of the standing and fallen timber from Oakville, if there's a connection there. What do you think?
Jennifer, I'm not aware of that connection. It's very possible because, as you mentioned correctly, Fishers do like a lot of both standing and downed dead timber, and one of the things they use that for is, you know, as small rodents dig through that downed and dead timber, that they go after the rodents, and so it brings in their food source. And then if they've got a snag, the fishers will use that snag for, you know, cavities to raise young in and just get out of the weather. So it is very possible that could be contributing to some of the Fisher numbers.
It would be a great grad student project if anyone wants to tackle that.
It would. I'll tell you, if you give us $70,000, we'll get a graduate student on it right away.
Well, I'd offer the use of my land because I want to see them expanding. The same with the redhead woodpeckers. It seems like they're cued in on those areas.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and the redheaded woodpecker is another species that we're starting to see more and more in terms of numbers coming back, and so that's a great animal to have back on your property as well.
Yeah,
we love them.
Thanks, Jen.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Appreciate it. And Ron in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi there. I'm wondering if the raccoons are still as prevalent in Milwaukee as they have been, or if they haven't seen any around, haven't heard any around.
Oh, man, they're still there.
I was going to say, if you can ever figure out how to get raccoons, I'll tell you what, bottle that and sell it. Because,
well, they used to come out of the storm sewers and
other stuff
like that. But we haven't seen them around for a while.
No,
maybe they're just in another part of the city.
Well, you know, raccoons are a really crafty animal, for one thing. They're very, very smart. They're extremely adept at living in and around human populations. Or living with human populations, and I'm not aware of any city, especially in the eastern United States, that does not have a raccoon population in that city. So one of the things raccoons will do is that, you know, they are very savvy about moving around when you are not out and about. They're also savvy about shifting their patterns, so they may be shifting more to nocturnal patterns and not so much diurnal. And things like that, and so they, you know, and they are primarily a nocturnal animal anyway. But
What do they eat?
They'll eat anything. Just about anything. Yep, absolutely.
Out of the garden and everything like that.
Oh yeah, they're
animal, vegetable, mineral.
Yeah, yep, they are. They will eat just about anything that's available to them for sure.
And if it's an animal, does it have to be dead first?
No, not necessarily. No. They're very, very good. Good hunters of small mammals, and you know, they'll eat birds and bird eggs and just about anything they can get a hold of, they'll eat it.
Worms and grubs and that too?
Absolutely. Yeah, they can actually do, as they dig up, especially grubs, they can do pretty significant damage to your yard and turf.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
All right. Thanks, Ron. And let's go to David near Casanova. Hi, David.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
I haven't seen too many other than Reedsburg, Wisconsin, but black squirrels are pretty popular there.
Okay.
And I live in Hill Point, Lime Ridge area.
Okay.
And I've got one in my backyard.
Yep. Yep.
Just one.
Just one.
Is that a genetic thing, you know, that it just happened to be two gray squirrels turned out a black squirrel, or is that... You know, did somebody snatch one from Reedsburg and drop it?
No, most likely it's an eastern gray squirrel. And gray squirrels are pretty common. They have a variety of pelage or coat colors. And you'll see albino gray squirrels occasionally with, you know, a true albino with pink eyes and pink nose. You'll see a piebald gray squirrel, which is just with the white coat, but not the albino, other albino traits like the pink nose and eyes. you'll see obviously a variety of gray type squirrels, and then you'll see black squirrels once in a while. So it's just a mutation in the gene that produces the color of the coat.
Okay, but this guy is as big as any fox squirrel I've ever seen.
Yeah, you know, it's not as common in fox squirrels that I'm aware of, but it probably is not unheard of that fox squirrels also have a variety of coat colors as well.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, David, for calling. Is there a list of birds, Bill in Madison wonders this, a list of birds that can be seen in Wisconsin during the winter season, perhaps with even sorted by habitat and located? A location.
Yep, Bill, that's a good question. A couple of places I would turn you to is, number one, if you just Google or use a search engine on your internet, Madison Audubon Society is one way. And there's down, I believe it's the left-hand side of the website that they've got like bird reportings or sightings. Wisconsin Birders Net is another one. Again, you can Google that. And especially for the winter, you know, between maybe mid-December and mid-January, there's what's called the Christmas Bird Count, and that's, I believe, run by the Audubon Society. And you can, Christmas Bird Count is a ongoing survey of resident birds in every state in the Union, and they usually will survey the same transect or route. And so you can actually find the transect that's nearest to your location, and then usually you can also pull up the birds that were seen each year on that transect or on that route. And so that's another great way to go about finding some birds in your area.
And Bill, if you tune in, if you're home cooking that Thanksgiving turkey on Thanksgiving, Noel Cutright and Bill Volkert will be on for sure. And we'll be talking about birding at that time. And they'll have even more probably to talk
absolutely.
About sites and places where you can go. So I hope you'll tune in from 11 to 12:30. On that day.
Yep, and
Bill
and Noel are just phenomenal birders and
just
have a good sense of what's going on. One last thing I would turn you to is Wisconsin Nature Mapping, and I think it's WISNATMAP.org. So Wisconsin Nature Mapping is a citizen science website specific to Wisconsin.
Mark in northern Wisconsin wants to know how to prevent people from trespassing on his land. Hunters, bear hunters and their dogs, what do you do?
Yep. Well, the first thing, if you have not already posted your property as no trespassing, make sure you get signs up, and you want signs with regularity across your property boundaries, so probably at least every 100 yards or so. And I'm not sure what the DNR, they probably have a recommendation for how far apart you should post signs, so maybe go on their website and look at that. But if you have not already posted your property, make sure you do that and post it with prominent signs that it's clear that this is private property and you're not welcome on the property if you haven't been invited. The other thing that is really important is that you or somebody else is on the property regularly to make sure that you're aware of what's going on in your property, and also advertise that people are out there, because that will also, people who are interested in trespassing, if they're aware that you're out there with some regularity, they're going to be reluctant to trespass because they're not sure when they might get caught. So a lot of times, people will lease their property to, it doesn't necessarily have to be a hunting group or a hunters. It could be to Boy Scouts or Girl Scouts or bird watchers or, you know, anglers or whatever the case is. But by leasing your property, you get people out on that property, and those people, because they're paying money, they also help you be vigilant about what's going on in your property, because they don't want freeloaders to come onto the property they're paying for.
Yeah, that's another good way to do it. And it's a good question. Probably other people had that same question in mind. So, and David, this was fun. You're going to come back and be with us next month?
Anytime, Larry. So we'd love to come back. Thank you.
David Drake, wildlife specialist with UW Extension. He's an associate professor of forest and wildlife ecology at UW-Madison. Tomorrow, Judith's on for me tomorrow, talking with Aaron McKenna of Baby Cakes NYC about gluten-free baking. And then at 11:45, talk about simplicity and downsizing from a woman who did just that. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network.